hey, folks, I'm WWE Hall of Famer Hacksaw Jim Duggan.
Tito Santana.
This is Kurt Angle.
This is Bret the Hitman Hart. And this is going out to Scott and Holly.
You are listening to the
Win Twice Wrestling Podcast
with Scott and Holly.
Oh, it's true. It's damn true.
And this holds for everybody. Ho!
Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to listen to the incomparable Win Twice Wrestling Podcast with your hosts, Scott and Holly. We always go over, brother, and that's the bottom line. Dig it? So sit back, relax, and prepare to be entertained.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Win Twice Wrestling Podcast alongside your co-hosts, Scott and Holly.
Hello.
How are you doing today, Holly?
I'm okay.
It's almost like it's the same day that I asked you this from earlier.
But I'm still all right.
But, you know, we don't need to pretend like we're doing anything other than doing them on a weekly basis for those that are listening. And again, so I'm actually away while this one's being broadcast. I'm probably having a lovely time, I imagine, because I'm not working. So that's, to be fair, that's all that really matters. When you take time off work, you don't actually have to go anywhere. Just not be working is enough, isn't it, of a treat. So again, to conform with time constraints, you're a busy girl, I'm a busy girl. Like, we're both busy girls.
Yeah.
And we wanted to make sure, like I said, getting consistent content out. And one of these mini-series we've kind of unintentionally stumbled upon, but I kind of felt like we might as well go with it because there's going to be a lot of material to cover, is the Saturday night main event.
Yes.
We laid the groundwork previously. We've done the first episode of that and we saw many different characters from the early 1985 era of WWE, or WWF, I should say, at the time. We've done a second one, which will have gone out the week before this, which we banked about a month ago, and we're going into the third. Well, again, not to put the cart before the horse, but I'll give you a little bit of my feelings on this show in general off the bat. They're not improving. I personally feel like they're not improving. And what's interesting is the TV rating numbers actually kind of reflect that.
Oh, really?
For this particular episode. Yeah, this is one of the shows that I'm able to get the TV numbers on. I'm sure there are certain websites where if you subscribe to this, that and the other, you'll be able to get this information. But to be honest, I'm not going to do that unless it serves a longer term purpose, which at the moment it just doesn't, if I'm being perfectly honest with you. But we've seen a few things already through Saturday night's main event. We've seen Hulk Hogan in his non-yellow wearing era, which is a strong emotional and visceral reaction from you, isn't it? We've seen a wedding.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we've seen every man, wife and his dog get food thrown at them. Now, surely we're not going to get three episodes in a row where people get covered in food. That can't possibly be the case. I guess we'll find out when we dive into it. So this is WWF Saturday Night's main event from the 2nd of November 1985. It was filmed on the 31st of October 1985.
Makes sense.
Which you'll pick that up as to why that's relevant when you see the theme of the show. The venue, Hershey Park Arena in Hershey, Pennsylvania. The attendance on the night was 8,000 people.
Is that where Hershey's chocolate comes from?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. Funny enough, being from Hershey is actually part of the first story that I've got to introduce you to. Because we've already done the background on Saturday night's main event, so I don't need to do that. But if there's any little tidbits along the way in the individual shows, I can cover that off. Again, attendance was 8,000 and the TV rating was 6.8. By no means is that bad, but it came down from being in the 8s. For episode 2 and episode 1. And episode 2 was only about a month before this, I think. I believe it was around August, September, and then this one was October. And I think the one before that was May. Now, what's interesting is that at the second Saturday night's main event, you might remember, you might not, they were building up the fact that we were going to get a tag team match where Hogan was going to team with Andre.
Yes.
Now, on paper, you think, holy shit, it's the two biggest baby faces, two of the biggest wrestlers of all time, but specifically at that time as well, that people must be flocking to see that in their numbers. And it didn't. Now, I wonder if it's because the content of the show turned people off and the numbers just dropped as the show went on. Because obviously the 6.8, I think, is they do it as an average of the overall period. So at some points it might have been like in the 8s and then people just go, oh, this isn't for me, and slowly turned off. obviously, I'm sure I could have, if I looked at the quarter hour breakdowns, which I believe will be available somewhere, I could probably find that out. But it's nice to theorise without having that data in front of us. I wanted to give you a little bit of background. So you already mentioned Hershey, Pennsylvania, yes, where Hershey chocolate comes from. But also, when I saw the fact it was in Hershey, that brought something else to my mind. So I've got a little story. Hopefully, you'll indulge me on this. Before we dive into the show, Holly, the first thing I notice is the location of the event, Hershey, Pennsylvania. The year is 1985. This is the area and time frame that Dr. Zahorian worked on behalf of the Pennsylvania Athletic Commission as a physician for these events. I've mentioned the name to you in the past in previous recordings, but this felt like as good of an opportunity as any to dive into the trial of Dr. Zahorian, which would effectively be a precursor for the government steroid trial against Vincent Kennedy McMahon. So first, I'd cite my source for this article as being in ESPN, the magazine, with the piece forming part of Sex, Lies and Headlocks, work from Sean Assale. I'd highly recommend you check out Sean's work for anyone that may be unfamiliar with it. Really good. So this is verbatim from this piece. Theodore Smith III had been a federal prosecutor for just 8 months when Bill Dunn's case file was dropped on his desk. A stout 35-year-old with a gut that showed his love for Philly cheesesteaks and the Pinot Noir that he made from the grapes he grew in his backyard. Smith had spent most of his career doing drug cases for the local district attorney's office in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. When Congress started toughening the federal drug laws and more narcotics cases began flowing into the federal courts, U.S. attorney offices nationwide hired additional staff. Ted Smith was swept into the federal job with that tide. One of the new laws that he was charged with enforcing was the 1988 measure that criminalised the distribution of anabolic steroids. It also moved dozens of drugs, including Tylenol 4 and Valium, onto the Food and Drug Administration's list of controlled substances. In October 1989, Smith finished listening to the tapes that Dunn had made during his drug buy in George Zahorian's medical office and concluded it was one of the stronger hands he'd been dealt. As he'd later say, it was an unremarkable case with the most remarkable characters I've ever seen. But Smith wasn't about to get cocky, especially when dealing with a doctor, so he waited for investigators from the FBI to slowly build a case. One of the things the feds did was subpoena the complete records of Zahorian's Federal Express account, and in doing so discovered a regular pattern of shipments to Vince McMahon and Terry Bollea, Hulk Hogan, Roddy Piper, and dozens of other wrestlers on Vince's payroll. Many of the packages were shipped to hotels in cities where the WWF was touring. A dozen more were brazenly sent directly to Titan Towers, the WWF's headquarters in Stamford, Connecticut. What was in those packages? Smith subpoenaed a parade of wrestlers, including Piper and Hogan, to answer that question before a federal grand jury. On March the 27th, 1990, the grand jurors had heard enough to indict Zahorian on 15 counts of distributing controlled substances, the main one being steroids. Fortunately for McMahon, the indictment of a pill-pushing doctor in Harrisburg was minor news, and the identities of patients he was accused of supplying were cloaked under John Doe references. The connection between Zahorian and the WWF went entirely unnoticed. It might have stayed that way had Zahorian's attorney not tipped reporters off to the fact that two of those John Does were Hogan and Piper. The use of steroids isn't limited to these wrestlers, the attorney said on the eve of his client's June 1991 trial. They're used throughout the WWF. Wrestlers either use them or they don't participate. That quote, intended to show that Zahorian was simply helping famous athletes get through their taxing work, turned the unassuming little prosecution into a national story overnight. When Zahorian was first indicted, a wave of concern swept through Titan Towers. Vince took the supply of steroids and needles he kept in his office and threw them away. But there was nowhere near the panic that ensued when, on the eve of Zahorian's trial, USA Today ran a headline on its front page asking, "Hulk, bulk, from a bottle?" Vince told his lawyer, a bulldog ex-US attorney named Jerry McDevitt, to get Hogan out of testifying. McDevitt appeared before a federal judge named William Caldwell and argued that Smith didn't need Hogan to make his case. He was only listed six times on the FedEx logs, McDevitt argued, far less than Piper. The collateral damage that would be done to the company by unnecessarily singling out Hogan would be immense. Caldwell bought the argument, and McDevitt rushed to the office to dictate a press release that was sent to any reporter who called. Hulk Hogan did nothing illegal and is not charged with any illegality, it said. He has no place in this trial and will not appear there. Instead, the focal point of the trial will now return to its proper place, the alleged illegal activities of a physician. On Monday, June 24th, the trial of Dr. George Zahorin began in a small Harrisburg courtroom overrun by reporters. Smith called just 9 witnesses, among them Piper, who seemed to have stayed up late the night before because, much to Smith's aggravation, he had a hard time focusing. Fortunately, Smith only needed him on the stand for 15 minutes, just long enough for this exchange. Did you have occasion to call Dr. Zahorin on March 23rd of 1990 and ask him for anabolic steroids? Yes, Piper replied. I did. And what did you ask him for? I asked him for some Winstrol and I believe some Decadurabolin, and I'm not sure, maybe an anti-inflammatory too. Did you receive the anabolic steroids you ordered from Dr. Zahorin in California? In a low voice, Piper answered, yes, sir. The verdict. After lunch, Smith rested, confident that it hadn't blown up in his face and his jury had been handed enough evidence to convict. Then, as he sat through a parade of character witnesses who took that stand for Zahorian, he prepared for the doctor to face the jury himself. If Smith had one worry, it was the physicians were skilled persuaders who jurors intuitively wanted to trust. If Zahorian did a good job portraying himself as a physician who felt compelled to help wrestlers in pain, that could hurt Smith's case. I knew these individuals, the bow-tied doctor began calmly. I treated these individuals. I'd carried out physicals and histories on them. They were taking minimal amounts of medication that was given to them in minimal doses. I knew it wasn't going to harm them. Over the 10 years that I knew most of the individuals, not one was sick. Not one developed anything that stopped them from wrestling. Smith worried about the last point. It was the doctor's one reasonable claim. He prayed the jury would not get sidetracked on it. It was a legal blind alley. The jurors got the case at 1:30 in the afternoon on June 25th. 3 hours later, they told the judge they had a verdict. Smith felt a pit opening in his stomach. Quick verdicts were usually acquittals. Juries that were about to send someone to jail generally took longer, if only out of guilt. So Smith let out a long breath when the foreman announced that the jury had found Zahorian guilty of the first count of illegally dispensing steroids to 11 more. The next day, every major newspaper in the country covered the conviction and the trial's damning disclosures about steroid use in the WWF. As he read the stories, McMahon winced. He was addicted, all right, but not to steroids. He was addicted to pay-per-views, and he could imagine what Zahorian's allegations were going to do to his business. It's the end of the article. It feels like a bit of a sidetrack, but this is literally in one of the buildings, and at this time, where Zahorian would have been there as the state assigned official, as a physician, and be dispensing drugs to the wrestlers.
God.
At this time, it technically wasn't illegal, because that changed in 1988, as the article mentioned. But then this, and the ties to the WWF, was then what led to Vince McMahon going on trial for conspiracy to distribute steroids to WWF wrestlers, which he was later acquitted of, whereas Zahorian was put in prison for. And Zahorian was actually used in the trial against Vince McMahon, which I'm listening to The Lapse Fan. If anyone hasn't heard it, I've mentioned it on a few podcasts previously. Great piece of work. Both of the guys really know their stuff. And they did basically they got the full transcripts of the court sessions and they're both taking on different roles in that and basically reading it verbatim, word for word, which is actually fascinating. And there are some of the characters in there, like Jerry McDevitt, who represented Titan Sports in Vince's trial, is an absolute pain in the ass. Like, he wants to go to sidebar with the judge every 5 minutes. It's fascinating, so I'd really recommend giving it a listen to. It's good. But yeah, I just thought this was a perfect opportunity given the arena as to where it was. And I'm assuming you didn't know any of that.
No, I didn't.
There you go. So the show opening. We now get to the meat and potatoes of what we're here for.
Yeah.
Back to the topic at hand and back to 1985. And Holly, it is a Halloween themed event.
It is.
What did you think when you saw all that?
I'll be honest, it just made me laugh.
Oh, good. Okay, yeah, not quite the reaction I had.
I don't know why. I wonder if it's because it followed on from something I watched very quickly before.
Yeah.
And it made me chuckle.
Massive change of pace.
Yeah, for sure.
So that opening shot sees Bobby Heenan dressed up as Davy Crockett, bobbing for pumpkins in what looks like a vat of chocolate. Standing next to him is Mean Gene, who is dressed halfway between a pumpkin and one of Kevin Nash's early WCW characters, Oz. Bobby's face is covered in what I really hope is chocolate, and explains that the animal pelt that he's wearing is raccoon and not weasel, as was suggested by Oakland. All the while they're talking, we can hear Tubular Bells playing in the background to really set the scene. It's like the horror music. That,
yes.
Because I always get confused with that and Halloween, but it's not. But it's the stereotypical Halloween music. And royalty-free, I imagine, which is why it's there.
Oh, yeah.
Heenan dunks his head in the shit tank once again and manages to retrieve a pumpkin, which Gene congratulates him on, although he now looks like he started to paint himself the same way that Roddy Piper did for his match at WrestleMania with Bad News Brown. Because it's a perfect half-face, well, dipping of chocolate. I don't know, it's bizarre. Very bizarre. Oh, God, where have we gone from here? Gene says King Kong Bundy and Big John Studd will have to be on top of their game for the Tag Team Spectacular main event, and Heenan responds saying he'll explain it in such a way that even Gene's small brain can comprehend. Heenan grabs two small pumpkins and indicates one is Hulk Hogan and the other is Andre the Giant, and then he cracks them together, causing them to explode. Is he winning you over yet?
I don't know if it's him winning me over or just the fact that as soon as immediately as I started watching this, I went and relax. Like, I didn't have to think about anything. I knew it was just going to be ridiculous.
Do you know what's weird? That it's almost like a comfort spot for you now.
Yeah, it's weird.
Oh, this is really weird.
I don't like it. I don't like it.
Oh, I love
it.
I really like it. That's great. The sideswipe camera transition now takes us to Hulk Hogan in his white American-made vest and red and yellow bandana hanging low across one eye.
Boo.
Yeah, I thought that might get that reaction. Hogan calls Heenan a weasel and reminds everyone how Bundy and Studd assaulted the Giant and why they did it. Hogan says that tonight will be a fair fight and he'll make sure of that. Brother. Hulk says that he cannot wait to see Andre mop the floor with these two. And as he says that, a meaty paw of the Giant slaps him on the chest, saying, "That is enough talking. Let's get some action, or let's get some Angel. Either way, you get the idea." No fucking clue what he said.
Oh, done with the talking. Let's get an Angel.
It did just make me chuckle, though, because it's not the first time he does it either.
No, like, it is the first
telling
time.
Hulk, like, is this, but later on, it's effectively just telling Hulk to shush. And I was like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I'm all right.
I thought that was funny. Holly is now elated. As we see a fully peacock-clad Jesse Ventura interviewing Piper, who himself is dressed as Super Hot Rod. Jess says that Piper has done it this time, and he got Uncle Elmer and the Hillbillies steamed that he interrupted their wedding. Holly is having horror flashbacks, and Piper is laughing maniacally. Jess calls Roddy a hero for trying to stop the wedding, and Hot Rod said that when the veil was removed and the two kissed, it looked like an intimate moment for two carp in the Mississippi River, which is basically quoting Jess line for line at the actual event.
Yep.
The two men howl with laughter, but I thought it looked more like when a bear goes rummaging in a bin than two fish kissing.
Oh, okay.
Jess asks why Piper plans on putting these idiots on Piper's pit tonight. And as he does, his feathered headdress keeps tapping Hot Rod, who swats at it like a cat.
It's so funny. It's so ridiculous. It just, honestly, tickled me. Really
is good. Is this the Carly Kiss Cam type stuff?
Yeah.
Brilliant. Piper says he's having them there for family planning. And also, that is the best place to make fun of them on national TV. The camera transitions once more and we see a tuxedo-wearing Mean Gene surrounded by Terry Funk and the mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart.
I saw his fucking megaphone before I saw him and I was livid. I'd gone from laughing to being angry.
We are only 2 minutes into this show and Holly has already been taken on an emotional roller coaster. I swear to God, we don't compare notes before this either.
No. Give me Jesse and then give me this fucking megaphoned prat, honestly.
Gene apologises for interrupting Terry chewing tobacco, which he then hocks a wedge of on the floor. Gene says that it's a big opportunity for Funk, as he goes up against the JYD, and if he's victorious, it could lead him to a future title match with Hulk Hogan. Funk says it's only a matter of time until that belt is around his waist, but tonight that can wait, as tonight he's here to house train the Junkyard Dog. Mean Gene asks Hart about those that say there is no place in professional wrestling for Funk's branding iron. Or his megaphone, I guess, in many respects.
Yes.
Hart responds saying he doesn't have to answer the critics, but Terry will. The camera pans back to Funk, who has a very odd look in his eyes as he marches down the camera before covering it in tobacco juice as he spits over the screen.
Vile.
It was vile. Now we hear the traditional Saturday night's main event music and opening video package centering around the participants that will feature on the show, such as Hogan, Piper, Andre, JYD, Funk, Savage, and Tito, to name but a few. The final shot, as always, is Hogan flexing for the camera as Saturday night's main event gets underway. We're getting familiar with the formatting of this as well, isn't it? It's like quick transition, quick transition, yes. Quick transition, opening, show. People being interviewed in the aisleway. It's very formulaic. They seem to be setting their ways on this. As the show officially gets underway, we head to the red dicky bow wearing Vince McMahon, who welcomes us to the event and lists some of the matches we can expect to see. The camera pans to the crowd, and what we see is nothing short of nightmare fuel. A fan has a massive Hulk Hogan head on and looks like one of the baseball mascots that have the race around the stadium. Right after, we see two fans dressed as gorillas with a King Kong Bundy sign, and one brilliant fan who's dressed like Mr. Fuji. And that one had me laughing. I enjoyed that one.
Yeah.
We're treated to a few more individuals in the crowd who dressed up for the occasion before Vince welcomes a man who is dressed for Halloween every single day.
So rude.
Jesse the Body Ventura. He's not wrong, though. He is not
so
wrong.
So rude.
Not wrong. The two men talk about the controversial wedding antics of Piper and Ventura, who says it wasn't him that interrupted the wedding, although that isn't to say he didn't disagree with Hot Rod's actions either. We're now taken to footage from not too long ago where we see Terry Funk assault a ring attendant by dragging him over the ropes and into the ring before stomping him into the ground. Now, Holly, if you'll indulge me, I'll tell you exactly why I wish Terry had really beaten the piss out of this individual. I assume you haven't heard of Mel Phillips before.
No.
So this article is taken from Rolling Stone magazine, and it was a big, big, big thing at the time.
Mm.
On a Sunday in March of 1992, World Wrestling Federation chairman Vince McMahon marched into a suite of law offices at 500 Fifth Avenue, a soaring pre-war skyscraper just up the street from the New York Public Library. He was there for a meeting with a young man about whom he knew virtually nothing. Vince arrived in the office of the Jacob D. Fuchsberg law firm. Apologies if I got that wrong. Or Fuchsberg. It actually looks like Fuchsberg. Fuchsberg? I think it's Fuchsberg. Accompanied by his longtime lawyer, Jerry McDevitt, and his wife, Linda, who was the WWF CEO. When he reached the conference room, where the meeting would take place, he saw the young man for the first time. Tom Cole was just 21 and possessed striking good looks. He had a mop of black hair, a square jaw, a gaze both confident and vulnerable. He was a big fellow too, broad-shouldered and tall. He was somewhat infamous among his family and friends for his ability to smile and charm his way into anyone's heart. But for Vince, Tom represented a huge problem. Tom Cole had been a ring boy. This was a long-standing role in the wrestling world. Whenever a travelling promotion came to town, it would hire a few local kids, teenage boys mostly. They would be put to work setting up and taking down the ring, a dangerous job that could end in broken fingers or crushed toes, running errands and any number of other miscellaneous tasks. In the 1980s, when Tom Cole was recruited, the going rate for a ring boy was generally about $80, plus bragging rights and photos with the superstars. At 13, Tom had fit the profile of most of the kids who became ring boys, a minor who didn't have a lot of adult supervision. But at 21, he was very different from other former ring boys. He was the first who had come forward with allegations of years of abuse, grooming, drugs, and sexual coercion within the ring boy program. These accusations had the potential to tear down everything Vince had built. At 13, the year Tom had become a ring boy, he'd run away from his mother's Westchester, New York home. Tom was always looking for more affection, more attention. He was an unusually beautiful boy. Girls fawned over him. It had been easy for Mel Phillips, a ring announcer and head of the ring crew, to spot him as a good prospect when they met at a local WWF show. And it had been easy for Tom to speak up to the fatherly care Mel Phillips offered him. Tom had started out working shows whenever the WWF was in Westchester County, but soon he was working shows in Manhattan too. Then Phillips started taking Tom with him on a regional circuit of wrestling shows, Baltimore, Boston, Philadelphia, and so on. I'd go from New York to Philly, and he'd have young kids waiting for him, boys at the shows, Tom would say in a 1999 interview published in a wrestling newsletter. Mostly it was kids with a broken home with no father. Just a drunk mother, alcoholic, drug addict, whatever. That's pretty much the type of kid that Mel was geared toward. Phillips would encourage Tom to invite his friends along. So Tom started taking his friends and bringing them to Mel. Lee, Tom's older brother, tells me, Tom died in 2021, by the way, but these guys were a little more street smart than Tom, they said. Tom, this guy's creepy. I don't like him. But Tom loved wrestling so much that he's like, wow, I'm at these wrestling shows for nothing. Sometimes the friends would stick around long enough for Phillips to ask them for time alone. From there, it got weird, Lee says, when he started playing with their feet and shit. Years later, in a draft of a legal complaint, Tom's lawyer would claim that Phillips would frequently caress the plaintiff's feet and would rub them against Phillips' own genital area. Other ring boys would go on to say Phillips did similar things to them. The other guys would say, Tom, this guy ain't right. He's playing with my toes and putting them up against his crotch and stuff. Lee says, I guess Tom was willing to overlook that part as long as Phillips didn't touch anything else. Phillips' boss, the WWF staffer in charge of the ring boy program, was a man named Terry Garvin. Garvin, born Terry Joyle, was a veteran wrestler from Quebec, a friend of WWF exec Pat Patterson, and like Patterson, one of the first openly gay men in the squared circle. By the time Tom entered the WWF's orbit, Patterson was not only Garvin's boss, but he was Vince's right-hand man. Tom said he had unwanted interactions with Patterson. He'd look at you when he was talking to you, he'd look right at your crotch, and he'd like lick his lips and shit, Tom said in a 1999 newsletter interview. He'd make sexual gestures by looking at you like that. He'd put his hand on your ass and squeeze your ass and stuff like that. According to Lee, once Tom turned 16, Garvin took an interest in him. During a 1988 car trip the two were taking from New York to Massachusetts, Garvin allegedly offered the teen drugs and alcohol, which Tom says he rejected. The draft legal complaint says Garvin made an unwelcome homosexual solicitation for Tom to engage in immediate sexual activity with him, which Tom said he refused. Whatever happened, Tom stopped getting ring work shortly thereafter. Then in 1990, Tom got a surprising call from Garvin. The WWF wanted him back. Garvin allegedly offered 19-year-old Tom a warehouse job that Garvin said could lead to bigger things with the WWF. Tom eagerly accepted. He said he wanted to be a ring announcer like Phillips. Garvin said they could discuss the matter at the Garvin family home. Tom went. They were alone. Garvin allegedly asked if he could perform oral sex on Tom. Tom said no. Garvin dropped the matter. Garvin wouldn't drive Tom home, so Tom slept in Garvin's garage. The next day, Garvin drove the young man to the warehouse. It was there, a few hours later, that Mel Phillips allegedly gave Tom some news. Garvin had changed his mind about the job. Tom was fired. There's laws against this, Tom recalled, saying to Phillips. You can't just do this shit to people. What am I going to do, man? I should fucking go to the paper. I should go to Vince McMahon or something. He'd done nothing then. But now, the brothers declared they wanted to take Tom's story public. In October of 1991, with no lawyer or publicist at his side, Lee got in touch with journalists he thought might be sympathetic, based on their critical coverage of the WWF. One of them was the New York Post sports columnist Phil Mushnick. Lee spoke with Mushnick at length. Phil said, "You guys are in the position where you better just get a lawyer already," Lee recalls. When I asked Mushnick if he told the men to find a lawyer, he says, "No, I remember just trying to tell them to be careful, that these are treacherous people." The Coles, he recalls, struck them as essentially grown kids, vulnerable, vulnerable, vulnerable fans. The Coles found an attorney through the Yellow Pages. They sought other ring boys to join them and found one named Chris Loss. He had a similar story of being recruited by Phillips at a young age and having his feet sexually fondled. They talked to reporters. They prepared a legal filing about Tom's experiences. On February the 26th, 1992, the Post published a Mushnick column, WWF to face suit alleging child sex abuse. According to several highly placed sources, Mushnick wrote, a lawsuit will be filed soon alleging that male WWF administrative employees and executives sexually harassed and abused underage teenage boys who were engaged as ring assistants in the mid and late 1980s. These boys went unnamed in the piece. Terry Garvin, all those stories are true, veteran wrestling journalist Dave Meltzer tells me. The stories about Mel Phillips, true. I always found Tom Cole to be honest, he adds. Like most people in the wrestling press, Meltzer had never heard of Tom Cole before Mushnick's story dropped. He'd been busy following leads on other scandals in the WWF, in addition to an ongoing meltdown of wrestling's public reputation due to revelations about the drug and steroid use. A wrestler named Barry Orton had just gone on a wrestling radio show to say that male-on-male sexual harassment was rampant under Vince and Patterson, and that Terry Garvin had once propositioned him, albeit before either of them were at the WWF. On top of that, a new announcer for Vince's World Bodybuilding Federation, and briefly the WWF, named Murray Hodgson, had threatened a wrongful termination suit against the WWF that alleged sexual harassment by Patterson. That one was actually blown out of order. I think that gentleman had a history of calling out people for sexual abuse. Sorry, that's me going away from the article. So that one was taken away because he had a history of making similar claims at other employers. And Barry Orton is Cowboy Bob Orton's brother, Randy Orton's uncle. So that is a family tie there. We're not too far away from the end. At the time, Meltzer didn't think anything of the accusations were going to amount to anything. Vince has gotten away with so much stuff, Meltzer says, because for the most part the sports people don't want to discuss morality with Vince McMahon, and the entertainment people don't want to think he's part of their world, and politicians don't want to be laughed at for looking at something that's fake. Vince made defensive manoeuvres. In response to the Post story, the WWF issued a statement saying it did not tolerate illegal or improper behaviour by any of our employees at any time, and that it would take responsible action regarding any legitimate claims filed through lawful channels. And on Monday, March the 2nd, 1992, Patterson, Garvin and Phillips tendered their resignations. Meltzer and Mushnick both promptly published stories that included comments from Vince. Mushnick claims Vince called him. He scooped Meltzer's weekly newsletter cycle by printing a March 4th item. Patterson and Garvin had resigned on the heels of a proliferation of reports that the WWF is headed for an enormously damaging sex and drug scandal. A few days went by without any major articles, but the industry was abuzz. The Post story will soon be joined by other mainstream newspaper stories focused on the WWF in the coming weeks, warned a leading wrestling newsletter called Pro Wrestling Torch on March the 5th. Vince denied all of the charges against both Patterson and Garvin, Meltzer reported on March the 9th edition of the Wrestling Observer. Trouble was brewing in another news medium as well. The Cole brothers' lives had been thrown into chaos. A producer for TV personality, Geraldo Rivera, host of Now It Can Be Told and The Geraldo Rivera Show, caught wind of the Coles' conversations with other reporters and found Lee's home phone number. She called to ask if Tom would sit for an interview. Lee says she threatened to ambush him with cameras at the house unless he acquiesced. Tom and Lee went from Lee's home in Utica to New York City to film the interview. That's what started the whole journey. The insanity, Lee says, because we decided to go down there. After filming the interview with Tom, Lee was still staying out of the public eye. The producer suggested that Coles hire a big-time city lawyer, in Lee's recollection. Her recommendation led them to Alan Fuchsberg, the son of a prominent trial lawyer and judge. Meanwhile, Vince had been running frantic defence. According to Mushnick, Vince made a pause-his-heart-out phone call to Mushnick, apparently fearing that Mel Phillips would soon become part of the public scandal. Vince told him that he had let Phillips go 4 years ago in 1988 because Phillips' relationship with kids seemed peculiar and unnatural. McMahon said that he rehired Phillips a few months after that with the caveat that Phillips steer clear from kids. McMahon told me that it was his great regard for children, his own personal regard for children, that made him get rid of Mel Phillips. Mushnick would later say in a deposition, Vince and Linda returned Phillips to the organisation with the caveat that Mel steer clear of underage boys, stop hanging around with kids, and stop chasing after kids. Vince allegedly said he'd brought Phillips back because the man really missed the wrestling and really missed the scene, but that he was gone for good this time. Vince would go on to sue Mushnick and the Post for defamation, but notably never disputed Mushnick's account of the call. Similarly, when reporter David Bixenspan contacted McDevitt, the McMahon's attorney, during the re-evaluation of the scandal in 2020, McDevitt noted that Cole said in a deposition that he never saw Phillips masturbate, but McDevitt did not address claims that Phillips rubbed boys' feet against his crotch, nor did he address Mushnick's and Meltzer's claims that Vince McMahon told them he was aware of allegations against Phillips as early as 1988. Meltzer claims he got a similar call from Vince around the same time as Mushnick in March 1992. He didn't say Terry Garvin and Mel Phillips were guilty, Meltzer recalls. He just goes, there's an innocent person here, Patterson. He didn't say the others. The morning of March the 11th, 1992, brought a San Diego Union Tribune article by Jeff Savage, another journalist Lee Cole had contacted, headlined "Sleaze, No Illusion in World of Wrestling, Sex, Drug Abuse Seen in Industry of Heroes." It featured a long summary of the ongoing scandal over steroid use in wrestling, as well as the allegations from a wrestler and a former announcer about unwanted advances of the WWF. Savage waited until the very end of the feature to mention the ring boys and to finally name them. "Boys are getting propositioned and played with all the time," fellow accuser Chris Loss told Savage. "You sort of put up with it because you could make a lot of money. I know if I would have slept with those guys, I'd probably be rich right now," Tom said. "It was really sleazy." As it turned out, the Union Tribune had prepared a full week's worth of exposés about the WWF. The story for the next day, March the 12th, was about the psychological effects of steroids and so-called roid rage. The same day, the Los Angeles Times ran a story about the WWF scandals, as did various news wires. That night, Entertainment Tonight gave Orton the floor to denounce the WWF. Later on in the night, on The Tonight Show, Johnny Carson compared WWF wrestlers to pop music fraudsters Milli Vanilli all in one day. The next day, March the 13th, Foxberg faxed McDevitt a courtesy copy of the lawsuit text, a move that's not unusual but certainly was not obligatory, and one that gave the WWF a head start on its strategy. Tom hadn't filed the complaint yet, but the text outlined Tom's allegation and his demand for more than $3.5 million in restitution. A few hours later, Lee got a call from Foxberg. Vince was ready to negotiate with Tom. They would have an in-person meeting in 2 days, on Sunday, March the 15th. It would prove to be a turning point in the lives of everyone present. But Lee wasn't invited. "Foxberg and his sister, who was also working on the case, decided to keep me out of the meeting," Lee says. Lee agreed to stay in a motel room while the meeting happened. Lee told Foxberg to make an ultimatum. "I said, Alan, this is the offer, $750,000. If they don't pay it, tell them no, and that we'll see them on TV," Lee recalls. "That's what I told him," Lee says. "He didn't do that." On Sunday, Vince arrived. He came to Foxburg Fifth Avenue law office along with McDevitt and Linda. Tom and Alan sat opposite them at a table. It was the first time Tom and the McMahons had ever met in person. Here is a reconstruction of what happened according to the accounts of Tom, Lee and Foxburg. "I told Vince everything that happened to me," Tom would later recall in an interview for a wrestling newsletter. "He looked disgusted and upset about it." "Well, you know, Tom, this is a terrible thing that happened to you," Vince said. "I want to make it right. This isn't the type of company that we run." These people have left the company. Foxberg raised the possibility of a big-ticket settlement. "Well, that's a lot of money that we're talking about," Vince said. "Listen, I'm not looking for money," Tom blurted out. "It was probably the stupidest thing I ever said," Tom would later lament in that newsletter interview. "I believed what Vince was saying." Foxberg kept walking out of the room and leaving me in there for 15-20 minutes at a time with Vince McMahon and his wife, Tom said. He'd go on walks with McDevitt and leave me in the room, and McMahon would talk to me and say, "It's terrible what happened to you, blah, blah, blah. We want you to come back and work for us," and this and that. But what they really wanted was to find out any other kids' names and any other people who were involved. Eventually, Foxberg and Vince started arguing. Vince's words grew frightening. "I'm like a rat," the boss said. "I'll go for the throat if I have to. I will not be backed into a corner." Vince got up to leave and Linda and McDevitt joined him. Tom panicked. "No, no, don't go," Tom yelled to the departing McMahons. "I just want my job back." There was stunned silence. "I love wrestling," Tom would later say to justify what he did next. "I loved working for the business. It's what I wanted to do my whole life. There was never a better feeling than going into an arena or going to a wrestling show and meeting people and stuff like that. It felt so good inside. You were so happy to be there. It was the best feeling in the world." Foxberg left the room again. Tom was alone with the McMahons and their attorney. "I've told this story to people and they just don't get it," Lee says. "He left this kid, this 21-year-old man, who's a street kid without an education, alone with Vince McMahon." "He was very shrewd," Tom would say of Vince, "and I was very young." What did Vince tell Tom in that moment of intimacy? Mr. McMahon explained to Tom that he had a difficult childhood himself, is how Foxberg would describe it to a reporter shortly afterward. Lee puts it more bluntly. Vince McMahon started telling him, "Tom, I was molested also when I was a kid." "I want to start on a clean slate with you," Vince said. "I want to take care of everything. How would you feel about that?" Tom got a good feeling that Mr. McMahon really cared, Foxberg said. Vince shook hands with Tom and offered him his job back. I thought that was the right thing to do, Tom would say, of accepting the offer. I thought, let me give it a chance. Maybe this guy didn't know anything that happened. Foxburg was called back in. Tom agreed to accept $55,000 in back pay and a job in the WWF's crew department. The $750,000 was never mentioned again. The lawsuit was dropped. I was in no league for Vince McMahon, Tom said. The guy's methodical. Vince McMahon, Lee tells him with grim confidence, can get you to do anything. And that's where it finishes. It's a lengthy piece.
God, yeah.
But I felt like it was, again, we can't, you know, we love professional wrestling. We talk about the good bits, but equally there's a lot of seedy, underbelly, sordid activity as well.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing Mel Phillips on the screen, which is the first time we've seen him on the show, with Terry Funk laying in the boots, and I was thinking, I wonder if any of the wrestlers knew about this. Because the wrestlers wouldn't have had any direct relationships or interactions, you wouldn't have thought, with the ring boys. That was more the road agent side of things. And I don't know. Were a couple of the kicks a bit harder than they maybe otherwise would have been? I don't know, but I like to think so.
Yeah.
Weird, isn't it?
God.
Really, really weird.
Yeah.
And it makes me sad that Pat Patterson's linked to it. Mm. Granted, Vince McMahon, you know, trust him as far as you can throw him, etc. He's pretty much, he just said Patterson was innocent, but he never defended really the others beyond mentioning, I think in passing he said about Garvin as well, but I think it's pretty much set in stone from what I've read at least, that Mel Phillips and Garvin were wrong-uns. So, you know, it's just, it's a story that was out there that made big national news, and it kind of tied in, like they said, as soon as one thing goes wrong in wrestling, they then rehash and revisit all the old stuff. Like, so this would have been 92, so I don't think Vince had been on trial yet. That was 93, 94. But the steroid scandal that linked the WWF guys in 1990 had already happened. And as soon as this came up, you notice they started then talking about the steroids and the drugs and all this stuff. And it's just easy to go back to that well. And I just thought it was quite a chilling end to it by saying Vince can pretty much do whatever he wants. And this was written before all the stuff about his activities came out as well.
Mm-hmm.
So quite harrowing.
Yeah.
But Holly, we please know we are back to the topic du jour.
God.
it's emotionally taxing, isn't it? And hopefully I didn't, you know, I did it justice bar the odd speaking mistake as I went through it, which I did try and correct. And I'm convinced, so that Fuchsberg was F-U-C-H-S-B-E-R-G. And I know that's Fuchs, isn't it? Fuchsberg.
I mean, you're asking the wrong girl.
But I think I said Fuchsberg each time, but either way, you got
the gist.
It
doesn't change the story,
does it? It doesn't change the story at all. But back to the show, and I now notice there was a female referee as well for the beatdown, which feels like a real rarity for the time. Women represent, am I right? At the entryway, we see Mean Gene once more with Hart and Funk, where he asks them to explain the actions we saw. Hart says it was TV camera tricks and special effects trying to make them look bad. Funk says, TV tricks or not, that is nothing compared to what they're going to do to that piece of dog meat, the junkyard dog. He screams, come on, Jimmy, we got some branding to do, and walks off.
Mm-hmm.
We're now taken to some more footage, although it's typoed it here to summer footage.
Ooh.
Oh, no, I did put summer footage because it was said it was from August. So Ooh. Apologies. From summer footage from Madison Square Garden, where Terry Funk is assaulting the JYD with a branding iron, causing him to convulse as rubbish is thrown from the fans into the ring. Not a fan?
That is dumb. Not hot, is it?
Well, let me get onto that later.
Because if it was hot, it wouldn't be the colour that it is.
Yeah, true. Also, but the way he's hitting him with it, he's not branding him, he's beating with him just, with a steel bit.
Which, fine.
That would hurt.
That makes sense.
Yep.
Don't say you're branding someone.
Mean Gene is now with JYD, and the crowd are chanting his name. Gene asks if he is looking for just the win or a measure of revenge also. JYD says what he pretty much says in every promo we've ever heard, that every dog has his day. The footage we saw was Terry Funk's day, but tonight it will be his night.
Yep.
Match number one. I'll be honest, it felt like about half an hour of the show had gone at this point.
It did.
I mean, half an hour of this recording's gone, but that was 30 minutes of me talking.
It took a long way to get here.
Terry Funk with Jimmy Hart versus the Junkyard Dog. Were you excited, Holly? I imagine you were raring for this
thrilled.
One.
Thrilled.
Yeah.
Thrilled. But actually the fact that JYD, we've seen him so many times now, and he's still a fan favourite as well.
Yeah,
and that's because our time frames are like mixed in, but I was like, yeah, fine, I'm not mad about it.
And yet, in my opinion, we have not seen a good Junkyard Dog match.
No.
On the show. Terry Funk has done some moments of decency, I think, in the podcast.
Yeah.
I thought his effort was at WrestleMania 2, which was just after this, so it would have been March the following year. Decent. But I like Terry Funk as well, so I'm coming at it with rose-tinted glasses. As the JYD makes his way to the ring, he has an ultra-serious look on his face until he gets to the apron where he commences barking for the fans. He enters the ring and removes his chain and slowly walks towards Funk, who's standing on the opposite apron yelling at the fans. Hart is furiously shouting through the megaphone for him to turn around, but Funk's not listening.
Even with the fucking megaphone?
Yeah. I was hoping we'd see Mrs. Junk... Or sorry, Mother Junkyard Dog as well to do the knee dance as well. Yeah, miss it. Miss it. Paying no heed to the warning, Funk finds himself pulled headfirst over the top rope and back into the ring. The bell sounds and the crowd are screaming with joy. Right hand from JYD and somehow Funk is lost in his own top as he hits the canvas. A warning shot is sent Hart's way also and he drops off the apron to keep his distance.
Yay.
Yeah, it is. Another big right hand drops the Funker and now JYD heads after Jimmy, who has scurried under the ring for safety. I know Funk is middle-aged and crazy, but he decided to climb over the ropes to go after JYD, who catches him at the top and crotches him over the top rope, yanking him by the ankle time and time again, making the ride as unpleasant as possible.
Yeah, I thought it was quite funny.
Yeah, it's a good move, but just Funk looks like a lunatic. Yes. Why are you climbing over to get... Just go out.
Just go, yeah.
Although it wouldn't set up the spot, so I get it. Funk takes a stroll around the ring to readjust the boys, and Hart checks on him as he disrobes. Back in the ring and the two men lock up. Funk with a big body slam but misses a running elbow drop. Body slam from JYD. He scoops him up one more time, marches to the ropes and slams Funk out to the floor. Hart is quick to check on his charge and Funk, in his confusion, wrestles him to the floor and looks to punch him until he sees who it is.
It's a cheeky roll around.
It is a cheeky little roll around, isn't it?
Yeah.
I like the idea of someone getting confused, even blind, between Jimmy Hart and Junkyard Dog.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like even just the weight difference would give it away. Yeah. And the fact that he's got a megaphone in his hand.
Well, true, prick. And wearing a suit. Prick! A more tentative Funk returns to the ring, and after a while they lock up once more. JYD forces Funk into the buckles and whips him across the ring before another big body slam. That should be a drink in this one, body slams.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's time for Holly's favourite, doggy style.
Oi!
Headbutts. I hadn't finished, don't interrupt! Look how I set that up in the notes.
I can't see. Oh,
top row. Top row.
Top row.
Top line.
Oh, you're such a dick.
Funk is punch drunk as he returns to his feet before collapsing and rolling to the apron for a breather. The crowd are booming JYD and Funk climbs over the guardrail to start a fight with the fans. In the ring once more and they lock up. Side headlock from the dog who is shoved off the ropes and Hart has grabbed him by the ankle. Out of the ring goes JYD and he has him by the mullet. Funk is in pursuit, but the dog sees it coming and backdrops the former NWA champion onto the cement floor. Ow. Hart furiously helps, just in case you wondered what that sensation was, probably ow. Hart furiously helps Funk to his feet and assists him back into the ring where he's greeted with a headbutt. Funk fires back with some rights and lefts before a big southpaw strike puts him on the canvas and we get a very close near fall off the back of it.
Yeah, was that the one that's quite slow?
Very slow count,
too, isn't it?
Yeah, I noticed that too. Sleeper hold applied by Funk and the JYD looks to be fading.
Boring.
Jess claims it is branding time and Vince agrees that we may well see this soon. The dog makes it to the ropes, which Jess calls the cheap way out. Whip off the ropes by Funk, who misses wildly with a clothesline, and now Funk is in the sleeper.
Ugh, snore.
Hart is panicked on the apron and seeing him, the dog breaks the hold and grabs Hart by the lapels before slingshotting him into the ring, but unfortunately for him, he's spiked right on top of his head.
Mm-hmm.
Also, worth noting, is the first time someone has landed on their head and received the Holly thumbs up of approval.
That's so harsh. But not wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Hart furiously tries to escape but is dragged back into the ring. The referee is entirely focused on the wrong thing as Funk sneaks up behind and cracks JYD with a megaphone to the back of the head. He throws fucking the evidence megaphone away and makes the cover for the 1-2-3. Funk is your winner. Hart now hands Funk the branding iron. Hart now hands Funk the branding iron and Funk swats a kick at the official's general direction. Funk looks to brand the dog, but he must realise that it will do very little with it being completely cold. Irrespective of that, the dog blocks it and narrowly makes his way to his feet. Slowly makes his way to his feet as the two men jostle over the possession of the weapon. Kick to the gut from JYD, and he drives the branding iron into Funk, sending him between the ropes and to the floor via the comically small timekeeper's table.
This did make me chuckle.
It's something about that skinny table, isn't it?
I know. And you'd think they'd have learnt by now to not put them right there.
Well, so, certainly with Funk around, he's going to find that fucking table, absolutely. I'll tell you. Now, the dog has heart and strikes him with a big right hand, which the crowd and Holly enjoyed in equal measure. Now we see Funk and JYD play tug of war with heart, and this results in the mouth of the South showing the crack of the South as his red pants are revealed to all. Funk is knocked back down to the floor, and the dog kicks and traps heart to allow him to brand him on the backside. Wait.
Okay, I'll hold on.
As he escapes to the outside, it looks like Hart has taken a few loads of man gravy as it has left a white imprint on his undercrackers. Now, Holly, hit me with your thoughts.
It's so bad, it's comical. But it's that whole, like, the branding iron is cold.
Yes.
Obviously.
White cold, apparently.
And it's obviously got some form of
powder.
Paint or powder on it to do that. Just hit him with it.
Yeah.
Just hit him with it, because also the fucking idiot squirms underneath as if he's being branded.
Or discreetly put like a little pot of ink or something out there, dip the end of it in there, and then on the arse, and then it will at least leave some sort of imprint.
It just
looked like he'd been to a fucking gangbang and just taken a few loads on the arse, is what it looked like.
Yeah.
It was weird.
But it was so bad. It was funny.
What did you score this match, Holly?
1.5 out of 5. Why, what's that face for?
1.5 stars out of 5. We've done it again.
Yeah, the thing is like, I think I'd gone past the fact of being like, this is shit. I think it's like, I just thought it was funny.
Sadly, this is one of the best matches, if not the best match we see on the entire show.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll get to you, main event, later.
Okay.
I cannot believe that I'm actually writing this, but we now go to a pie-eating contest. And no, not that kind of pie, sadly.
Oh, see, I've put, they all like a cream pie.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
That is good. More upsettingly is that what I see on my screen. We have a host of WWF wrestlers and managers dressed in fancy dress. Hogan in a Greek god get-up. Mm-hmm. Bundy as Lincoln. Tito as the Lone Ranger. Macho Man as Tarzan, and Miss Elizabeth as Jane, but my personal favourite, the Iron Sheik as Batman, and Nikolai Volkoff as Robin.
Yes.
The pie-eating contest is between Captain Lou and King Kong Bundy, and there are no two more fitting bags of milk that I could think to take part in this. The contest, were you ready to be turned on, is my only question.
I fucking love food play, yeah.
Yeah, especially when they're going at it. Like,
especially with these two. My God, everyone that's there... Fuck Savage and all of that lot. Just, these two absolute meat men.
Meat men,
demolishing
indeed.
A cream pie.
Well, I went with bags of milk. I thought that was quite fitting. The contest starts, and they both eat exactly like the Cookie Monster. A lot of mashing and no swallowing.
That's so true. So true.
That's literally all I could think of.
So true. Although, for me, the thing that really gets me is the hands.
Yeah.
In... Like the scooping. And I was
scooping and straight shoveling down the gullet.
It's not even the eating, it's the scoop.
Well, there's no eating, it was mashing and no swallowing, which is where we know it differs from your style. As the contest winds... No, because if you're having pie, you have to eat it, don't you?
Okay.
You're... Jesus.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah.
You were the one that mentioned cream pies. As the contest winds down, both men look like they have tongue-punched multiple fart boxes, and Captain Lou is announced as the winner. Bundy claims the fix is in, saying nobody can out-eat him, and throws one of the pies in the faces of Albano, who proceeds to eat it without so much as flinching, which had me in stitches.
It did make me laugh. There was also a clip in there of Heenan. Heenan, I think, does make me laugh quite a few times in this, and he's got the raccoon or whatever it is on his head backwards.
Yep.
And he separates the legs and flips the tail off. I just thought, yes, it's actually amusing.
I told you, Heenan's great. Honestly, he really is. If you're keeping score, Holly, that is 3 Saturday night main events and 3 occasions that desserts have ended up in somebody's face.
Mm.
Mean Gene asks if the victor has any words, and he does. He asks for another slice of pie.
Fine.
You fat bitch.
Eat the one that's around your fucking mouth.
Yeah, or any of the bits that you just mashed and threw on the floor.
Yeah.
Piper's Pit.
Oh, God. This absolute dross.
As we return... Well, Holly's got strong thoughts on this one. I think that's
this,
obvious.
This gives me a little bit of something, but still.
As we return from commercial break, we see the SNME logo has been adorned with some Halloween images, and we now head to the ring where we see Uncle Elmer, Hillbilly Jim, and Cousin Junior, who is rubbing his fingers thoroughly between his toes, which turns my stomach.
Right. And I've got a bone to pick with these three. Why are they not still in their costumes? Why are they not still dressed as the Three Musketeers?
I forgot they were dressed as the Three Musketeers.
That I would have loved.
That would have been
all
bizarre.
All sat on a little school bench, about to be told it off.
As he's massaging between his toes.
Yes.
Gross.
Yeah.
Checking the constitution of the jam down there.
Toe jam.
Toe jam. This is the first time we've seen Uncle Elmer since his wedding dance and marriage, and it looks like married life is sitting well with the farmer, as he looks like he's easily lost the will to live. We take a brief trip back in time when Piper interrupted the nuptials, and we follow this up with Jess's take on proceedings as well. Now in the ring, we can see the trio have been joined by Roddy Piper and Cowboy Bob Orton. Piper says howdy to his three guests, before saying howdy specifically to Uncle Elmer and Jim, who he refers to as Mrs. Elmer. Hot Rod asks if they're having a nice time, and asks the new husband what the world has been dying to know. What happened on the wedding night?
And let's be clear, no one wants to know.
Well, I think she did, because we haven't seen her, so God. She probably got smothered. Elmer replies that it is none of his business. First line he's got right.
Yeah.
Piper asks if Elmer and his ugly wife have thought about family planning at all, and Elmer once again says it's none of Piper's business. Hot Rod continues to prattle on about the wedding before Elmer warns him to shut his mouth. Hillbilly Jim gets to his feet and asks Piper why he said the things he did about Uncle Elmer at his wedding. Hot Rod says he didn't, which is a foolproof response. Now Elmer is standing as well. Took him a while, but he got there. Piper again says it wasn't him, and then throws Jess under the bus, blaming Livid. Him, but does say that he agrees with the man.
Livid.
Jim says if Ventura is such a man, why doesn't he come up and say these things to Uncle Elmer's face?
At which point I'm literally like, yeah, let's do it, let's go.
He did.
Mm-hmm.
He said it in the poem at the wedding party.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what he's saying. Yeah. He did say it to your face. You were there. Him into cake. Which is a weird thing to say at a wrestling show, but that is what happened.
Yeah, it's so true.
The cameras now take us to the commentary position, where we see Jess remove his blazer to reveal a purple tie-dye tank top, removes his glasses and heads towards the ring. Beret still on. Just want to point that one out.
Yeah, I made a little note of his look here. Of the tie-dye vest, flared fitted jeans, mm-hmm. cowboy boots, and a beret. It's a look.
Where's his outfit?
What do you mean?
He had a peacock hat on. Where's that? Why does he not have to stay in
there's
costume?
There's one person that stays in costume this whole entire show.
Vince?
Yes.
Yep.
Even when he goes, oh, we'll get there.
Oh, fuck. Right.
Right.
Do you know what? Okay, fine. No, we're going to jump ahead here. Ventura is steaming, and he screams that he called it the way he saw it, and he isn't backing down on nothing. Piper says then... Sorry, no. Piper asks them what they came here to do, as Piper wants to talk, but they look like they want to fight. Orton signals from behind the interviewees that he's ready as he goes on his hands and knees. When Piper says he doesn't want... I need he made a very bad joke there. When Piper says he doesn't want any trouble, as he knows how intelligent they are, he shoves Cousin Junior, who goes head over heels thanks to the kneeling ace. A big right hand from Jim sends Orton to the outside, and Piper just avoids the second, making sure he exits of his own accord. In the ring, an Elmer is closing in on Ventura, who's backing off. He just manages to escape the clutches of Elmer thanks to Hot Rod, but the big man does grab his beret, which he stamps on with Hillbilly Jim.
So pointless.
As the segment draws to a close, Elmer shouts at Junior to stamp on the hat. But the poor inbred fool doesn't even know which way is up and just stands there.
I know, it's so ridiculous. I thought I was going to get to see a bit of cheeky three-on-three action. I got a bit excited that Jesse was going to be in the ring.
Well, they
honest.
Tease it later, don't they? So we'll have to see what comes from Saturday night's main event number four.
Ooh. Oh.
I could be wrong. I don't think I've ever seen Jesse wrestle under the WWF. He did under the WWWF.
Right.
But since he became announcer, I could be wrong. I don't think he ever wrestled.
Man.
Could be wrong. And I sigh for legitimate reasons, okay?
I love this.
We now go backstage to the second of three Halloween-themed games as we now arrive at the Great Pumpkin Dunk.
This is so bad. It's so funny.
It's so shit.
It's so bad.
With Miss Elizabeth there, I was hoping we would see her involved, but sadly not to be. She and Savage are standing in the corner of Heenan, who will be competing against Cousin Junior. In Junior's corner, we have Tito and JYD, the latter of whom is dressed as a mummy, but still wearing his chain.
So funny. So good. So, so good.
Mean Gene asks JYD about him dressing up, and he responds saying he's easing himself into it and he cannot wait to see Junior dunk his head and eat pumpkin real fast, real fast, real fast, real fast. Thanks for that. Savage will be holding the bag for Heenan, not a euphemism, and Tito will be holding the bag for Junior. As we see the two men dunk their heads into the chocolate syrup, we see some fantastic camera shots of Miss Elizabeth as Savage is barking the number out. Four! He got four! No, just, no one's asking you to shout, Savage, but fuck me, try stopping the man. We can also see that after a while, Heenan is now cheating and using his hands to retrieve the pumpkins. Brilliant.
Yeah, it worked.
Heenan is declared the winner, and Gene announces that things are all tied up. I hadn't realised this was a team competition. So just found that out now.
Yeah, cool. I didn't know either. No. Especially until there's one where I'm like, oh, I see now. Yep. I see.
So we've had how many matches so far? One. And so fortunately, we don't go into another match. So as we return from commercial, we see Mean Gene standing in the entryway with The Brain, King Kong Bundy, and John Studd. Gene asks a now cleaned up Heenan how he felt about winning the pumpkin dunk earlier this evening. Heenan says he had no doubt in his mind he would win, and anything he sets his mind to, he makes it happen, which includes the two gentlemen he is standing with beating Andre and Hogan in just a moment. Bundy talks about the unbeatable Dream Team, but says that he and Studd will not be put down. Studd says how everybody thinks that the Giant and Hogan are the best tag team in the world, which is probably overlooking the tag team champions of the world, but I digress. Studd says that in a few moments, John Studd and Bundy will show the world who the best really is. Yes, he called him King Kong Bunny, which is a t-shirt. And also, do you know what
Pops
bunnies...
bunny ears on.
Not only that, do you know what bunnies are known as? Easter bunnies. Egg.
Oh, I see what it's, you've done there.
See what it ties up.
So intertwining.
Yeah, John Studd was ahead of the curve with the whole egg jokes for him.
Can I ask a question? Because
please.
My memory is shocking.
I've done
a lot
of talking, so go for it.
Haven't we seen this before? Who was Andre with when we saw this before?
Tony Atlas.
Okay, thank you. But I literally was like, again?
It was, yeah, which is going to be weird for the people that are listening to this in order, because we recorded that about a month ago.
Yeah.
But it's actually the episode that's coming out just before this one.
Okay.
So it was, yeah, a tag team match between Tony Atlas and Andre the Giant against those two. It broke down and Hogan came out, and that's when they then announced this was going to be the match for this show.
God.
But not going on in the main event spot.
No, true. Also, just to let you know, their combined weight is 58.7 stone.
Jesus.
Well, they said 823 pounds.
So you converted it.
So I didn't. Google did, obviously. I'm not that clever. I can only count to six, as we've just established in
and
the
only
recording
twice.
Before.
And only twice, and then you're done.
Yep.
Where do we go from there? I've completely lost where I am here. No, I'll get that. Oh, no, there we go. Mean Gene is now standing with Hogan, Andre, and Captain Lou. And he first congratulates the captain on his win before asking what he has to say. Captain Lou, and then immediately passes it over to Hogan.
Yeah. Lovely manners.
Just literally goes, tell me what you mean, Hogan.
Mm-hmm.
Cool, thanks for that. Maybe just don't be there. Ooh. Maybe just don't be alive at this point. Just go away. Like, with your elastic bands in your face.
Oh yeah, I hate that.
I mean, to be fair, you made me laugh at the pie eating contest. Mm-hmm. I'll take that back. Where do we go from here? Mean Gene is now standing with Hogan. Pass over to Hogan. There we go. Hulk says, enough of the nonsense. Quite right. Quite right. Enough of the bloody nonsense. And that out here, it's all business. He refers to Andre being the 8th, 9th and 10th wonder of the world, and that neither Bundy or Studd could beat the Giant in a fair match. As with earlier, Andre, palm on the chest. That's enough talking. We go to the ring.
I love it.
And it sounds like Zoidberg, but I defy you.
And she was about to say, your impression does sound like Zoidberg, but actually it sounds...
It's
very close to him too.
Mine is more Zoidberg than anything.
It's
because
like throaty.
Because I can't get as deep as Andre can, because he's a fucking giant, so to speak. Well, I can only imagine. I can only imagine the girth of that kielbasa. Yeah. I couldn't think of a French sausage there, so I left it. But now, Holly,
yes.
Praise be, we get to the second match of the evening.
So excited.
King Kong Omelette, Big John Studd with Bobby the Brain Heenan versus Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant with Lou Albano.
Mm-hmm.
We once again see Hulk Hogan wearing white, and although this match has a main event feel, I'm well aware this will not be an attractive match. You can't argue, it's a weird one, because it does feel like a main event. It's not the main event position, but the atmosphere, the people involved, it feels big in
even
many
just
respects.
Putting Hogan and Andre in it automatically feels like it should be.
And then you go, oh, it's going to be bad. But it's like a dichotomy, because you know it's a main event type level match, but you know it's going to be poor quality.
Mm-hmm.
But that is what how it came across to me. As the bell sounds multiple times, we start off with Hulk Hogan and King Kong Bundy for their respective teams. The two men trade verbal barbs at one another until Hogan shoves Bundy in the chest and is gifted one in return. Shoulder block by Hogan barely moves Bundy, but the flying knee that follows drops him to the canvas, but only gets a one count. Hogan looks to body slam the big egg, but he holds onto the ropes and Hulk falls to his knees.
I was quite impressed about the...
He picked him up quite nicely,
didn't
he?
Didn't he?
Yeah, like dead weighted him as well. I thought when he started to do it, I'm going, oh, he's going to fall back with Bundy on top.
And it'll be the pin like that which we've seen before.
It's the patented move with Hogan and a big man, to be fair.
Just impressed by his strength, I'll be honest.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that won't take anything away from him. Clubbing strikes by Bundy to the back, but he misses a clothesline off the whip, and Hogan is firing away with right hands, much to the delight of the crowd. Face first into the buckles goes Bundy, and a corner whip and clothesline follow in quick succession. In comes the Giant, who strides over the top rope and begins choking Bundy with his own singlet.
I've seen that before.
Every time. Literally, we saw this in the last Saturday night's main event.
I feel like at some point I could now actually write an Andre match, because I know about four things that are going to happen in it.
Yeah, so
and that's all that happens.
What points do you hit the moonsault?
Yeah.
Oh!
Could you imagine?
No, because he'd die. Where do we go from here?
It's a good question.
Thank you. We're in many respects. Face first into the buckles goes Bundy. And in comes the Giant. Okay, right, so I hadn't quite finished that line of thought. So he's choking him with a singlet. Jess asks what the matter is with the incompetent referee, and he's not wrong. Bobby Dickfingers over there is just walking around the ring, not calling out anything. It's clearly choking him. He's just really odd, really annoyed me.
Anything goes.
I'll be honest, didn't know the name of the ref, so I took a punt. Big headbutt to the back of Bundy, and Hogan is tagged back in. From the second rope, the Hulkster connects with a double axe handle.
Oh, God, so fucking boring.
But the action goes too close to the heels corner, and Stud drags the champion into the buckles, allowing Bundy a free shot. Stud now the legal man, and he drops Hogan with a shoulder tackle. We now get a bit of a mix-up as Hogan ducks under a back elbow and elevates Stud into the air for an atomic drop, but he instead half hits a back suplex because he was leaning weird.
Yeah, it's a bit
they
odd.
Did very much a miscommunication there. Andre gets the tag, and as Hogan holds Stud's arms, the Giant chops at him. Andre continues to fire away on Stud in the corner, but an errant right sends the referee flying across the ring to the other side, and now all four men are in the ring. I'll be honest, I thought, okay, disqualification is going to be what happens here.
Well, yeah, because that's the rule, right?
No. Mm-hmm. Not what we get here. Big Dikembe Mutombo no on that one. Andre continues to fire away, yep. Bundy strikes Andre from behind, and he is then met by Hogan, who knocks him to the floor. We have official Joey Morella checking the condition of the first referee, who has just come to. Vince informs that whilst we await for a replacement official, so we're pretending we can't see Joey Morella organising the two teams in the ring, we'll head to a commercial break. As we return, we see Stud run right into the dreaded, for many reasons, bear hug.
God.
Fortunately, it's only short-lived as the Giant elects to choke Stud before whipping him into the boot of Hogan. The champ gets the tag and Ventura makes the correct call on commentary, saying he has never before seen a wrestler strike an official and a replacement come out with the offender not being disqualified. I'll be honest, I thought that was going to be the finish.
Mm-hmm.
Hogan connects with a running clothesline which drops Stud. Vince then really confuses me as he says, "The big boss man coming over the ropes." But he's obviously referring to Andre, who called everyone boss and was considered the boss of the locker room. We see Spit fly out of the Giant from nothing. Mm-hmm. He's just, yeah. And I also heard a story, and I could be wrong, but Hulk Hogan claimed that Andre never cleaned his teeth either. And that just fills me with levels of dread. Could be wrong, because Hogan talks mainly out of his ass for a lot of the time. But still, I don't know. I believe that one, sadly. So I don't mention Andre's teeth anywhere, but I heard that recently, wanted to get that in. We see Spit fly out the Giant and a great camera angle of Stud lying on the floor as Andre towers over him. Big boot from the Giant, off a whip, and Stud rolls to the outside. Andre looks to follow but is blindsided by Bundy, who clubs him into being tied up in the ropes with the classic Andre spot.
Of course.
Except he's on the outside now.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit different.
A little bit, but I don't care.
I bet you were pleased. Hogan jumps in for the save, trying to untie the Giant, but Stud trips him up and holds him in place as Bundy! As Bundy connects with a running splash. That I really liked.
Mm.
I actually thought it worked really well. By far the best moment of the match. Andre, helpless, can only flail away with kicks, yeah. And now he's being clubbed and kicked by Stud and Bundy. The referee has lost all control and calls for the bell, so we still get a schmoz finish.
Yeah.
What?
I don't really understand it.
Oh, I'll tell you, it's not the worst finish of the night.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Intercontinental title match, much?
Okay, yeah,
fuck
yeah.
That. Right, mm-hmm. I'm gritting my teeth now. I'm so angry with it. The fans are going nuts as Hogan regains his feet and sees his friend being attacked, and he runs to hit Bundy just as Andre manages to free himself from the ropes. Big boot off a whip from the champion sends Bundy to the floor. The Giant traps Stud, allowing Hogan to hit a running clothesline that sends him to the floor also. Silly move, really, as it would impact Andre too, and he sells it as such.
Yeah.
If you're clotheslining, I'm right behind him.
Yeah.
Hold him to one side if you want to do that. Howard Finkel announces that the winners by disqualification are Hogan and Andre, but Hulk doesn't look pleased. Is he shaking his head, indicating that he wanted the pin, brother?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of this match, Holly? And
really,
what did you score it?
Really fucking long celebration afterwards as well. Like, honestly, just get off my telly. I love the music, and I've literally put, I'm glad to hear that, as opposed to the NWO music that we had 45 times.
Nice.
I gave it 0.5 out of 5.
I was generous. One star.
Okay.
Because it had a great atmosphere to it.
Oh, it did,
and I
like
that one spot.
Yeah.
But I thought there were too many dumb things. I think one star in retrospect is quite high for it, but it was what it was. That's what
I
felt at the
time. It wasn't too long either.
No.
I mean, the celebration afterwards, too long. But the match itself, not too long.
Kind of not really a celebration, though, because you mention it. But as soon as the announcement is made, Mean Gene is in the ring and with the victors and asks Andre what it felt like winning in front of this packed crowd. Andre screams he didn't get enough and he wants some more, which is exactly what King Kong Bundy said after the pie-eating contest. Andre asks Bundy and Stud to come back to the ring and that he isn't through with them yet. Hogan reiterates that he said those two couldn't beat Andre in a fair fight and that Andre and he will never lose to the two of them. Andre and Hogan do a bro handshake and we hear Andre say, "I may be a champion, but you're the world champion. So thank you for clarifying there, Mr. The Giant." Rusamon, it doesn't matter. Mean Gene tries to cut away, but Andre starts bellowing that he challenges Bundy and Stuffed. Stuffed. Big John Stuffed.
Ooh.
Mean Gene tries to cut away, but Andre starts bellowing that he challenges Bunny and Stuffed. Oh,
that's a cute little
there
tag
we
name.
Go. Anytime and anywhere in the world. Bunny
you
and Stuffed.
Flip it though.
Stuffed and Bunny.
Stuffed Bunny. If that
sounds like some
team.
Sort of weird sex act that I'm unfamiliar with.
Yeah. Oh, have you tried the Stuffed Bunny?
Oh, no. I'd love to give her a Stuffed Bunny.
Yeah,
it
works.
See, sounds like a threat, that,
works,
isn't it? When it comes
it?
Out of a male's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what, Mean Gene's the man of the moment, isn't he? Fucking
he's,
everywhere.
He's everywhere.
He's like fucking syphilis at a college dorm. He is fucking in
syphilis.
Everything.
God.
He is
all
in
the STIs, everything. Syphilis.
Yeah. What would you rather go with?
Gonorrhea, maybe?
Why?
Don't know. Isn't syphilis like an old disease?
Gonorrhea is not. What do you mean an old disease?
Isn't it like not a thing anymore? Syphilis. I don't fucking know.
Well,
I don't know.
Well, that was okay.
I'm not going to Google it. That'll really fuck my algorithm.
Herpes.
Yeah, okay.
Herpes.
Okay.
Like herpes at a college dorm. He's fucking everywhere. Fucking word police over here. Sorry, doctor. Fuck me. You're an old thing.
I don't know anything.
Doctor Zahorian. Which reminds me, can I get some steroids later? Because I
yeah,
sorely
sure.
fucking need them.
Just get them out and boot my kill.
Brilliant. Just to be clear, we don't have any.
No.
The man of the moment, it seems, on this event, Mean Gene, is standing at the entryway with Macho Man and Miss Elizabeth,
yay,
who are, as always, matching in their attire, which is excellent. Sparkly Black and Orange gets the big thumbs up from me. Gene asks Savage why he chose a woman manager, and that's his direct terminology. Macho Man glares at him and says, "What kind of a man would ask a question like that? He's either a blind man or a stupid man." I can't do the voice. "What kind of man are you, Gene Okerlund?" Gene asks Miss Elizabeth why she chose wrestling. She actually answers. Savage lets her talk and says that she's always had an interest in sports and wrestling, but she specifically wanted to help Randy in any way that she could.
I love the way she says his name.
Randy.
I love it.
Yes, she's got that southern drawl, hasn't she? Give her a southern twang. She is getting a lot of whistles as she talks from the fans, and Savage is getting a lot of boos. Gene notes that it's very rare for someone to get a title shot so quickly in the WWF, and is he ready for the opportunity? And he confirms he's ready, able, and willing. And don't ever ask him a question like that again.
Yeah, let's go, woman!
And then walks off. He's changed the phrase there, by the way. Ready, willing, and able is the phrase, but ready, able, and willing. Yeah, again, apologies for the impression. I can do little words of his, but not full-on sentences. And then, weirdly, we hear, Gene! And Mean Gene jumps. It must have been someone from the production crew, because I cannot work out why that happened.
Oh, yeah, fair.
Funny. Someone is shouting Gene's name from the production team, and he jumps on the third call. Match time.
Yep.
Macho Man Randy Savage with Miss Elizabeth versus Tito Santana, friend of the show's Tito Santana, for the WWF Intercontinental title. How did you feel about this?
Happy.
Two of your boys.
Very happy.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, that was going to be short-lived.
Oh, come on now.
What do you mean, come on now? As Savage makes his way to the ring to pomp and circumstance, he's incredibly paranoid as he looks over his shoulder to see if anyone is touching Elizabeth.
I mean, they were. They were giving her a grab, to be fair.
Where were they grabbing? I didn't see. Arms, I assume?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, but cool. Because she looked concerned.
Yeah, she should be.
She always looks concerned. It's great. She goes from... to.
I wish everyone could see your facials, but yes, I agree.
Quite. I'll leave that. We return from commercial break and see that Tito is in the ring already to defend his title. But he came in second, I assume?
Well,
so I don't think he was in the ring.
Go with that.
The bell sounds and the two men lock up. Savage is immediately bull rushed to the ropes and the ref has to break the two men apart. Jess calls Santana Chico and is corrected by Vince that it's Tito. That's what I said, Chico. And obviously this leads to Tito Santana actually calling his own book Don't Call Me Chico.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jess. They lock up once more and snap break the hold with Tito ready to throw hands. Savage rushes and leans between the ropes to argue with the fans, because why not?
Yeah.
A third lock up, and this time, thanks to a pull of the hair, Savage marches Santana into the ropes. They jostle back and forth for position until a big right hand from the challenger puts Tito on the canvas. Snapmare and knee drop from Savage, who introduces Tito to the buckles. Clothesline is ducked by the champion and he reverses a hip toss attempt with one of his own, but misses a running elbow. Savage takes the long way about going to the second rope. He like goes out, up, down.
Yes, it's a bit just, odd, isn't it?
Yeah, seems, it's a bit like, it reminded me of Funk from the beginning of the show. And what does he hit from the second rope, Holly? It's
fucking double axe handle.
Double axe handle to the back of the neck on a kneeling Tito, near fall for the challenger. Reverse chin lock by Savage and the champion has to fight to get back to his feet and looks to escape with a top wrist lock, but Savage powers him back to the canvas in the hold. Again, Tito fights his way back to his feet and elbows free but takes an elbow himself to the top of the head and eats a body slam moments later. Up to the top rope goes Savage and he takes flight but lands directly into a right hand to the midsection from Tito. Knee lift by the champion drops Savage and he stamps away as the crowd cheer him on. A flurry of left jabs land and a big right drops the challenger. Body slam by Tito, but as he hits the rope, Savage slides out of the ring and looks to escape through the crowd. No such luck as Santana returns him to the ring. Wisely, Savage slides out the adjacent side immediately, causing Tito to chase, and when he re-enters the ring, he cuts the champion off on the apron, knocking him to the floor. On the outside, Savage is looking for a pile driver, but this is blocked and he settles for hitting a knee lift. Savage looks to return to the ring, but is pulled back to the outside and we hear the bell.
Yeah.
What a steaming pile of shit that ending was.
Yeah.
Hate it. Hate it. Mm-hmm. They weren't outside long enough consecutively for 10 seconds.
No, true, because they went in, out, yeah, in. And also, who's counting?
Well, yeah, that's the point. We didn't see the ref counting. The bell just sounds. And yeah. I was actually surprised because I was like, I'll be honest, I thought this was the event that Savage took the title off Santana. Because I'm pretty sure that's who he beats for the Intercontinental title, because come WrestleMania 2,
yes,
he's defending it against George the Animal Steel, who will live rent-free in my head from the zoo clip when he called the hippo King Kong Bundy. Bundy is getting bullets. He's the new Corbin. He's every show, Bundy's getting bullets.
It's Corbin.
Yeah.
Odd.
I didn't see that coming, that because it didn't seem right. I was like, oh, they're still outside.
And also, I know I'm a bit biased, but the matches that we've got, give me this one for longer over anything else.
Completely agree. It was shaping up to be a decent match. Not excellent.
No.
But decent.
All right, yeah.
And I think that's reflected in the score.
Okay.
And I've marked it down. Sorry, that people are more interested in your ratings anyway.
I don't think they are.
So what have you got for yours?
I've overrated, and I know I have, and you knew I would, because it's Savage, right?
Can I guess what you're going to say?
Yeah, go on then.
2.5.
Oh, no, 2.
Okay, so I'm actually quite close to you.
Okay.
1.75.
Okay.
It would have been 2.25 if it had gone on longer and had a non-shite ending, but mm-hmm. I couldn't overlook that. It was because normally, like you said, you can see when the count out's going to come, and they just didn't see it, which to me means that something wasn't right.
Yeah. Or they've like gone, oh, we're cut for time, Bellet.
And again, this Bellet, and this would have comfortably, as you said, be the best in-ring, certainly on paper, match on the card.
Yeah.
Just felt like an opportunity missed.
Really did.
Now, what we see next, Holly, I can only describe in a therapist's office with dolls. Dolls?
Dolls.
Dolls, with guys in dolls.
Dolls.
Dolls. Dolls, hey, all right, sweetums.
I'm going to be real with you here.
Yeah.
I resorted to chocolate and a cheeky bevy when I saw this absolute pile of tripe.
So what Holly's referring to there, in very flattering terms, the cameras take us backstage where we see what appears to be Mr. Fuji taking either a violent shit or having a nervous breakdown, potentially both, as he's making strained weird noises as he rubs his knuckles against his temples. Now apologies for what I'm about to do here, but I'm going to try and recreate it a little bit.
Down. Wow.
Which clearly means that he's ready to do battle. Fuck me, that hurt my throat, so I can only apologise for your ears. Okay, we get taken now to Ricky Steamboat, who drives his palm through two boards and elbows a third in two. Before we head to the next segment, we see what I thought was Volkov and Sheik about to kiss, but it was actually them practising passing a pumpkin back and forth from under their chin. Fucking weird.
Now that is actually a fun game, but I don't want to see these men break in character.
Yes.
Doing that, do you know what I mean? Like, it's a bit odd. Some people, it makes sense, like it's funny, but those two especially, I was like, so we're completely going off the fact that these two are meant to be like massive heels here.
Yeah,
bit odd.
America Hawk Tour, or USA Hawk Tour, excuse me. Holly, I know we get asked a lot of questions, I certainly pose a lot of questions to you over the course of the shows, but one that's really, like, it's niggled at me, and I've tried to find a way to actually get it into an episode. But how do you think Hot Rod celebrates Halloween? Because that's always pressing matter for me.
This is why I had a drink. It's so bad. And I had to resort to chocolate fingers because I have no Freddos.
That's how so anyone that's not English, chocolate fingers.
Chocolate finger is a biscuit, and it's like the best biscuit ever.
It's a biscuit covered in Dairy Milk chocolate.
Oh, it's so good.
But
it's
Holly saying shortbread. I resorted to chocolate fingers is questionable.
Sounds probably a bit dodgy, but so good.
And this, I haven't had one for ages.
This is a left-handed wank with no finish. This Piper segment here.
So Mean Gene sends us over to what we are told is Hot Rod's rented American house to see how he spends the holiday. In the kitchen, we see Piper marvelling at a cutout of himself, which is a weird thing to own. He says that it looks like Stallone, except he's handsome. He then spins around and shoves a stick into a bowling ball and spins it tight for any children that come knocking at his door, claiming it's a candy apple. And we see he also has some bricks in tinfoil, which he will pass off as chocolate. They are in Hershey, after all. Vince now appears in a tuxedo,
out of fucking nowhere. Let himself in the front door.
Troy McClure in The Simpsons. Oh, hi, I'm Troy McClure. You may remember. Like, it's just...
It just barges in. Yeah. In the same fucking outfit that he's had on all damn day.
Very much so. So he appears in a tuxedo and asks Hot Rod to turn down the radio in his own house.
Mm-hmm.
Which happened to be blaring his entrance theme.
Of course.
If that wasn't odd enough, Vince suggests that Piper can't use the toilet downstairs as the plumbing isn't working. Hot Rod says it's quicker to run to the outhouse and back than it is to flush, but he's busy preparing for Halloween. I'm now utterly confused as Vince asks Piper how he celebrated the holiday back in his native Scotland. Piper stops dead, puts a stick under his nose and mimics a tribal person before throwing the stick at the camera and saying, "Oh, look, a giraffe. I ain't no native." It is only now that Vince realises Piper is wrapping bricks and bowling balls, but Hot Rod says, "No, no, 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 no," like Mrs. Doubtfire, before explaining how the children keep coming in groups and ringing the doorbell and coming back, more groups ringing the doorbell, and it's playing on his little psychotic mind. He says in Scotland, it's trick or treat, so he can do whatever he wants. He then deadpans and say, "If they bother me once, they don't bother me twice." Quite sinister.
Go on, all right, child snatcher.
Child snatcher or it. The doorbell now goes and we see children gathered at the door. One says, "Remember what happened last year?" Hot Rod invites the kids into his house. Is that what you do?
Not sure.
That's what you do.
I don't think so.
And spots that one of them is dressed like Hulk Hogan. Piper says that the last time he saw him, he was catching dogs for the county. He comments the kid has the same size arms as the Hulkster as well. One of the children is clearly in witness protection as they are covering their face, but asks why the candy apples are so big. And Piper says it's because he's such a wonderful person. The little Hulkster asks what the chocolate bars are, and Piper says they're special chocolate that he got from Hershey, Pennsylvania. That wasn't the only treat he picked up from Hershey over the years. Just ask the duck. Piper puts one of each of the into the kids' bags, which causes the bottom to completely rip apart, although he does force the bowling ball in to really hammer the point home. Piper goes on his hands and knees and starts hiding the candy up his kilt and throwing some out of sight before he empties a bowl of candy corn into the two bags because he's not a fan of that. He then hands it to the children. They thank Hot Rod, who continues having a breakdown on the floor with chocolate-covered fingers. Different kind of chocolate-covered fingers to what Holly was talking about earlier. The kids leave and say to one another, "I hope he likes his chocolate-covered peppers," and we hear Piper scream.
Mm-hmm.
The cameras take us back into the house where Piper is drinking water out of a vase and throwing it into his face. Vince is clearly enjoying himself as he isn't doing his forced ha ha ha. He's really laughing and says, "Trick or treat, Roddy!"
It's quite
with
amusing.
His arms wide open.
Vince's,
and that's it.
Vince's reaction alone made that funny.
What is this fever dream?
But why do we need it?
What is happening?
What does it add to our life?
Well, it adds a lot because we won't fucking forget it, will we?
No, I know, but I don't know.
From there, Vince, just apropos of nothing, is talking to Hogan, who's back in his gladiator costume.
It's so bizarre.
Back at the event, we see Hogan in his Hercules costume, which is what I was told it was, standing beside Vince. Hulk is asked what he thinks of what he just saw, and he thinks that it's great seeing children outsmart that no-good Rowdy Roddy Piper. Hogan says it gives him faith in all the little Hulksters around the world. That's it. Mean Gene enters Mr. Fuji's locker room and asks the master what kind of preparation it is, as he's never seen it before. Mr. Fuji says it's very simple, and we see him smash his palm through a gimmicked brick before between two breeze blocks. He does it again, saying that one is Ricky's knee, and Gene says it's very impressive indeed. Fuji gets to his feet and drives his head through a board, saying it's Ricky again, before exiting to the commercial break. Main event of the evening.
This is... I wouldn't say this is the main event. I'd say what comes after it is, just to make myself feel a bit better.
Oh yeah, okay. Mr. Fuji versus Ricky the Dragon Steamboat in a Kung Fu Challenge, not sponsored by Carl Douglas. We see Mr. Fuji stood in the ring alongside Don Morocco as he waits the arrival of the dragon. In keeping with the trend of the night, Steamboat is stood with Mean Gene at the entryway and is shown some footage of Mr. Fuji and Don Morocco effectively hanging him over the ropes with a belt, and it actually looked quite brutal. Because they were like swinging him from side to side and then pendulumed him over the top. And it really did look quite brutal. Gene asks what will be different about the match tonight. In a weird choice of phrasing, Ricky says that Mr. Fuji and Morocco have only ever felt the physical being of Steamboat. But tonight, he will have to contend with the dragon. I love Ricky, but your promos, man. B. bit stinky. And also, bit stinky at times.
This is just shit.
What do you mean it's just shit?
I don't want to watch that.
What, Steamboat give his physical presence on Mr. Fuji?
It's why? Oh, I don't know. It just makes me feel bad.
Why?
For Steamboat.
Oh, yeah, because it's massively underutilising him.
Yeah.
Why wasn't he allowed to join in and dress up?
True.
Bit unfair. Steamboat makes his way to the ring and leaps over the top rope and strikes a martial arts pose that precisely nobody in the ring gives a fuck about. He just stood there and they just carry on about their business.
I'm intrigued how you've notated this. I wonder if it's going to be as good as my notes.
I can only hope. I can only hope they compare. Jess says that Mr. Fuji is a martial arts champion in his own rights and won't be intimidated by the dragon.
It's all those 5Ks he runs.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's also basically, they're basing this solely on the fact he's Japanese.
That's it.
That's all you need.
That's it.
And they're like, who's not Japanese but almost looks Japanese? Ricky Steamboat, let's put him in a match.
Honestly ridiculous.
The bell sounds after the ref has checked the gear of both men, and we see Morocco in a Hawaiian shirt and sunglasses standing on the outside looking like Lou fucking Ferrigno.
You're fucking inside. You are inside. You absolute moron. Take your glasses off.
Yeah, Jess.
No, that's different.
Why? He's inside?
He's in the exceptions group.
Okay. Steamboat is striking poses in the ring like he's fighting demons that only he can see floating around his head before he blocks two strikes attempt by Mr. Fuji?
Fuji.
The Fugees. There you go. Imagine. One time. A kick gets blocked and the dragon delivers two chops to the top of the head. Armwringer is followed by two backhands to the gut. One to the back and a leaping kick to the back of the head which puts Fuji down. Now it appears that Fuji just flat out kicks Steamboat in the... Right. Now it appears that Fuji just flat out kicks Steamboat in the balls. Didn't see that one coming, did you, Rick? Double throat chop sends the dragon down to the canvas. Falling headbutt to the midsection. And now Mr. Fuji opens the speciality Kobe Butcher's counter with high premium beefy chops. Steamboat looks to fire back with a number of strikes and chops that brings Fuji down to his knees. It doesn't last, however, as Fuji strikes him to the clavicle and down goes the dragon. A strike to the face of a kneeling Steamboat, and now we see one of the favourite fucking things I have ever seen in any wrestling match ever and will ever see. What happens is Mr. Fuji gets two fingers out,
mm-hmm.
Okay? Spread them apart like fangs.
Mm-hmm.
Turns them upside down. So he's pointing upwards.
Yeah.
Places them underneath the chin of Steamboat. And with his amazing martial arts power, he powers him across the ring, causing him to front flip with just his two fucking fingers.
Strong fingers.
I tell you what, lucky lady. Lucky Mrs. Fuji.
God.
Imagine he's waving her around the room like a fucking clapper. He doesn't know what's going on. Christ knows where I am in these notes. Magnificent bullshit. Elbow to the back of the head by Fuji and another clavicle shot drops the dragon. Back kick by the Fuge, who now looks for the old martial arts suplex, but it gets blocked and Steamboat hits one of his own. The dragon heads to the top and takes flight with a surreal looking missile drop kick that he tries to throw like a Power Ranger.
Mm-hmm.
It lands and we get the 1, 2, 3. Steamboat is your winner. As the bell sounds, Morocco hits the ring and sprays the dragon in the eyes with a red mist. Does that mean Morocco is now a Japanese demon heel? Is what I want to know, because I thought that was only... Also, did he have that in his mouth the whole time?
Oh.
Warm, spitty...
Moist.
Red mist. Lovely. Steamboat sells it tremendously well, and the two men beat down the dragon in the ring as he crawls looking for respite. I was waiting for someone to help him. Yeah, no one does.
One comes.
They fuck off.
They're busy. They're prepping for the game.
Would you score this?
Do you know what? I gave it 0.5. And I gave it 0.5 purely because Steamboat's physique looks amazing. Yeah?
So someone looking good gets it. Yeah,
his Steamboat body just looks ridiculous.
Yeah, it's well toned. It's an athlete's power body.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll
that's
give
it.
That.
That's it.
So I gave it 0.25 stars, and all of that, two finger throw. All of it.
I just don't know what the point was.
Oh, shit. I heard them say, I'll be honest, I was hoping I just misimagined or misremembered what I'd heard earlier in the night, but I heard with a kung fu match, and I thought, I don't want that. So I tried to ignore
that,
it.
But I thought that would be part of the, like,
shithousery backstage.
Shenanigan games.
Yeah.
Alas, no.
But you're right, Holly. Mm. That wasn't really the main event.
No, this is.
We see Mean Gene and the lovely Miss Elizabeth, and they go to demonstrate the technique used for the pumpkin pass.
I'm amazed Randy let her do this.
So am I. Old Dirty Boy Gene clearly looks down her top as they attempt the pass and says, Or something like that, anyway. Vince and Jess have now made their way backstage to sit in on the pumpkin pass, and they recap the Halloween events that have led to this finale. Jess is asked what he thinks about Captain Lou winning the pie-eating contest, and Jess pulls no punches by saying he isn't surprised he won, as he's a big, fat, sloppy pig, and I'm crying with laughter.
It's his delivery.
Yeah, oh, it's just everything. So brutal. It cuts to the bone, doesn't it?
So funny.
They discuss Heenan's win in the pumpkin dunk contest, and Jess weirdly says, of course Bobby won, as Bobby takes brains. Does that mean he takes dicks? I don't know what he means by that.
I don't know.
I have no clue what he's going for there. As Vince is explaining the rules of the pumpkin pass, Jess is tossing the hand-sized pumpkin up and down in his hand and has noticed that JYD is exaggeratingly following the fruit. Get it, Holly?
Like a dog.
He's a dog.
He wants to chase it.
He does. He wants to play some fetchies because he's got a lot of zoomies left in him. The face team are clearly turning their backs to the cameras to cheat using their hands, and Jess calls it out. When it eventually gets to Captain Lou, he starts convulsing and drops the pumpkin to the floor. Too much sugar from that pie-eating contest is what I can imagine there. Jess announces that Super Hot Rod has entered the team for the heels, and when the contest begins, they do the exact same cheating that the faces did, except they get the capes involved.
Yes, and again, here, I am amazed and didn't really understand why Roddy is in between Elizabeth and Randy. And I don't... Firstly,
I think it's because they're fucking with Savage.
Yeah. There must be, because I was like, firstly... I did think, okay, how's this going to work? I mean, ultimately, it doesn't really matter, but...
It eventually gets to Liz, and while she is trying to pass it to Hot Rod, which must have been sending waves of rage through Macho Man, it's dropped to the floor. Commendable camera work once more as they shoot a low angle up of Liz.
Mm-hmm.
Savage starts chastising Liz for being a failure, and it's announced that the face team have won. As the camera fades away, we see Savage grab Liz by the chin, and I'm ready to fight a dead man and still get my ass kicked.
Mm-hmm.
No. Mm-hmm. Don't be doing that. Jess, Vince and Gene wrap up the show by Jess first calling Gene an ugly little pumpkin, before declaring he and Piper want the hillbillies in the ring at the next Saturday night's main event. Gene makes a poor attempt at a clapback, and Jess, who simply says, "Ain't I pretty?" and starts laughing. We do another false finish, as Gene has now gone, and Jess says he's concerned if this is Vince's idea of a fun time. We see the credits roll and feature a number of clips from the events we've just witnessed as the show comes to an end.
Yeah.
What do you think of the show, Holly?
I feel like maybe hysteria had started to set in when I watched it, because as looking at it, it's absolute shit. Like, it's so bad. But I just found it so funny. Like, it actually made me laugh out loud multiple occasions. I gave it 5.5 out of 10.
You're fucking shitting me.
It cheered me up. I was having a bit of a down day and it really made me chuckle. I enjoyed it. Sorry that I've rated that higher than the show we did before this.
TNA.
Yes.
I give this 1.
Okay. Yeah.
The matches were crap. Yeah. Granted, the thing is, it's weird, because I agree with you, there are multiple things that made me laugh in the nonsense, but that's not what I want to see in a wrestling show.
Oh, isn't that what I want to see? But it elevated my mood
a
little.
No, because I had to make notes on it. So
true.
If I was just watching it, I probably would have found it slightly more entertaining, but
yeah,
one, it's like the worst show I've seen that we've done.
Okay.
I really struggle, because like, normally there's a match or something I can pinpoint and say, that was good. Nothing.
Yeah, true. None of the matches were... I know 5.5 is absolutely ridiculous. And I know it's an overly high score.
It's remedial, is what it is. It's ridiculous.
It just cheered me up on a bit of a down day.
I'm glad it cheered you up. I mean, like I said, there were parts that really did have me laughing, but for what I want to see, that's not hitting...
None of the wrestling content was enjoyable.
Well, I can't remember what your highest score was, 2. Mine was 1.75. Yeah. That is the highest scoring match on the night. That's not good.
No.
That's not good at all. No. I think out of all the episodes we've done, it was fun doing the back and forth with you going over it in hindsight. But this was painful for me to actually go over and do notes for.
Yeah.
And I did it again in one sitting.
Yeah.
But I didn't struggle like that with TNA.
Yeah,
so that's the most recent example of, I know our recording sequence is a little bit out of whack.
Yeah.
But to me, this was a slog. But fun all the same to go over with you at the end. So... God, we've covered the show rating. So this one I've actually made some notes for Holly's special section.
Oh, okay.
So
you're going to hit me with your notes?
I'm going to hit you with my notes and my rhythm stick. So for the outfit of the night, there's some contenders. There's a lot of contenders here. So the ones I thought you put, Jess, Savage, Liz, my favourite, the Sheik.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's anyone other than them, I will not accept your answer.
Okay.
So I feel like Jess, Savage and Liz were on there.
They're in the list, yeah.
Were there other, so there were others in the list?
I name... Yeah, there's a couple others.
Bobby Heenan?
No.
Ricky Steamboat?
No.
Not Mr. Fuji. None of the people in the tag match. Is it fancy dress people?
Of course it is.
Okay, so Three Musketeers.
Yep.
Oh, who else was there? The Lone Ranger?
Zorro.
Yeah. Oh, it was Zorro, wasn't it? They said that. I mean, he definitely looks more like the Lone Ranger, but whatever.
Yeah.
And Abe Lincoln?
No. There's one I mentioned it earlier.
Oh, I don't remember.
JYD.
Oh, it was the Mummy.
It was the Mummy.
Okay. So I think you're still going to go Savage for his combination two outfits, I think.
Yeah. So I had, Jesse in the intro with the masquerade mask. Very much so enjoyed that. Iron Sheik and Volkoff as Batman and Robin. Ridiculous. Whoever thought of that deserves a medal. Elizabeth and Savage, first mentioned as Tarzan and Jane.
Yep.
Ridiculous outfits on both of them. Ridiculous. Tito as Zorro. Looks great. Elmer and everyone else is the Three Musketeers. Don't want to love it. Really fucking do. Really did. JYD as the Mummy. Jean dressed as a pumpkin.
Oh, okay.
Did tickle me.
Fair enough. And we saw that a few times.
And then, they're back. So Savage and Elizabeth, all-round winners. Mainly, though, for the black and orange sequin robe. And even when Savage takes off his robe, I like the pink and pink pants, yellow boots.
Yeah, that's a classic Savage look for the time.
This was, thank God he brought it out of the bag for that match, because if he didn't have that match, I'd have been stuck with choosing between him and Jesse, and I don't know what I would have done.
Still a Sheik for me. I think it was too funny not to.
It was very
funny. Gone, to be fair, if he hadn't been like that, I would have probably gone Liz.
Yeah.
I thought she delivered a lot on that episode.
Like a rocket.
Yeah, she did. I mean, she always does look good, but that one I thought was actually, because she had two outfits as well.
Yeah.
Matt, remember the WrestleMania 4? Four outfits on the night. Right. Sensational. I don't think that'll ever be touched, that combination there.
Nope.
Well, I'm glad that you enjoyed the show. And before we send listeners off into the sunset with a lovely ending, which at some point I'll come up with more of a formal, official, professional sounding one by myself, have you got the socials there?
Sure.
Sure. Oh, okay.
Sure. Yeah. I'm going to freeball it.
Go on then, freeball it.
WinTwicePod@gmail.com. People can email you the show suggestions before you say, what can they email me? They can actually email you whatever they like.
Okay, cool. And what else?
WinTwicePod on everything else.
Cool. And I know Holly has a lot of fans out there on Instagram, so get creative with what you send her is all I would say.
Get creative? What do you mean?
I don't know. You know, they've got nice little stories and stuff and thoughts about this, that and the other.
Really
just
like
get pictures
it.
Involved or something, that's all I'm saying.
Any pictures from shows that people
pictures of shows would be great. Yeah.
You're bizarre.
I'm not bizarre.
Bizarre.
Goldust is bizarre. Right, so that brings us to the end of another episode of the Win Twice Wrestling Podcast. Until next time, everyone, take care.
Bye.
Until next time, this has been a Win Twice Wrestling production. Peace out.